this evening, Lord. I'm sure it'll be a very
interesting year.
Better?
Yes.
I'd like to thank you all for coming out this evening, Lord. I'm sure it will be a very, very engaging conversation. This is the final in a series of the conversations that we've had in the course of, throughout the course of the year under the title Covering Conflict. One of the missions of the Institute for Religion, Culture, and Public Life is to establish conversations between the academic world and the non-academic world, that is to say, the wider community. And in New York, by extending out into the city, and in fact, extend out into the world. Last year, we did a series of conversations with fiction writers, and next year, we'll do a series of conversations with visual artists. This year, we've been doing it with journalists. The title, Covering Conflict, carries multiple meanings. Conflicts, of course, take many forms. It's not just military conflicts, political conflicts, racial conflicts, it's gender conflicts, a whole range of conflicts. In covering, I want you to hear at least two meanings of cover, too. To cover can be to cover as a journalist does, but to cover can also mean to conceal. And all too often, much of the covering the journalist does conceals as much as it reveals. One of the real virtues of Nicholas Kristof's work over the years has been to turn us toward that which is usually covered in the concealing sense of that word. I suppose it's more than appropriate that Nick be here today on the day that the Pulitzers were announced just at the other end of the hall, because he has won two Pulitzers in the course of his career and has written a column for the New York Times since 2001. He grew up on a sheep farm in Oregon, and his parents both taught Portland State. I mention those two facts because I think such experiences are important in forming the way one sees the world. He went to Harvard, and after Harvard, he received the Rhodes Fellowship, spent a year in Egypt studying Arabic, and joined the New York Times in 1984. He was correspondent in Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tokyo, and in 1990, Nick and his wife, Cheryl Wu Dunn, won a Pulitzer Prize for their reporting on the pre-democracy, on the pro-democracy student movement in Tiananmen Square in protests. That work eventually issued in a book called China Wakes, The Struggle for the Soul of a Rising Power. I went to China for the first time this fall, and that was the one book I knew I had to read before I went. My only regret was that they left China too early and the story didn't come up to the present day. In addition to the excellent reporting, one of the things that I found most engaging and intriguing about the book was a very sophisticated reflection on the moral and ethical issues raised by for a journalist working in China at that time, perils that some of the people they interviewed found themselves in as a result of the reporting and the questions that that raised. More recently, his most recent book he wrote with his wife, Cheryl Wudan, called China Waits, The Struggle for the Switch, The Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. It's a remarkable book, if you haven't read it, both painful and uplifting in many ways. Again, very, very careful reporting that grows out of very, very careful listening to people. Book culture has brought some copies in the back, and after our talk, Nick has kindly volunteered to sign books for any of you who are interested in picking up a copy. One of my favorite writers is a French writer by the name of Brice Blanchot. Blanchot says at one point, writing turns us toward that from which we would rather turn away. Now, Blanchot is as far from a journalist as one can expect. And yet, in certain ways, it's always seemed to me that Nicholas Kristof's work does precisely that. A deep moral question informs all of his work, and he turns us toward that which is all too often covered and overlooked. He travels to the world's forgotten places and brings back stories of those who are usually invisible. has deep concern for those who are marginalized by society, women, children, young girls. Yesterday's column, if you happen to read it, was Dateline, Victoria Falls, Zimbabwe. And I want to read two paragraphs from that column because they start me. It tells the story of young boys who have to walk, get up 4 o'clock in the morning and walk 9 miles, I think it is, to school each day. The household stirs to life each morning when Abel, who's in the 10th grader, rises at 4 and sets off barefoot on a 9 mile hike to the nearest high school. He has no watch or clock, so he judges the time from the sun, knowing that it will take 3 hours to get to school. Abel and the other children have no money to pay school fees or buy notebooks, but their teachers allow them to attend class anyway because they are brilliant students who earn top grades. They're reminded that talent is universal, although opportunity is not. It's the last sentence I want to stress. They're reminded that talent is universal and opportunity is not. It's quintessential Christoph statement, it seems to me. One of the programs that he runs, which I think is quite admirable, is a contest, I guess, and is Win a Trip with Nick Christoph for college students and high school teachers to enable them to go to Africa. I just wish he would start one for college professors and university professors as well. Engaging Nick in conversation this evening will be Sheila Cornell from here at the J School. This is a remarkable background. She was the inaugural director of the Tony Stabile Center for Investigative Journalism here at Columbia. Before coming to Columbia, she had a very distinguished career in the Philippines. Throughout the Marcos regime, she reported on human rights abuses in the growing democracy movement in the Philippines. In 1989, she was one of the co-founders of the Philippine Center for Investigative Journalism. Sheila and her colleagues reported on social issues ranging from military to poverty and corruption. She was the winner of the 2003 Magsaysay Award for Journalism, Literature, and Creative Communication Arts. I love the titles of her books, Coups, Cults, and Cannibals. Pork and Other Perks, Corruption and Governance in the Philippines. There are others. Nursing the World, Filipinos in the Global Care Industry. And finally, Cockfight, Horse Racing, Boxing Match, Why Elections Are Covered as Sport, Lessons Learned from the 2004 Campaign Coverage. These are two very, very busy people, and we are very, very grateful to them for giving us their time tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark, for that introduction. Welcome, Nick, to the Journalism School. Let's start with your book, because there are copies of, I'd like to remind the audience, there are copies of it back there. You can get copies at the back and have Nick autograph them later.
I'll give you 10% of the royalties today.
I actually got a book on my iPod Touch. Anyway, the book is on the bestseller list, and it's like on its seventh printing.
21st.
Oh, I read. My information is obviously dated.
It tapped a market that nobody, neither we nor the publisher, really knew existed. It really struck a chord.
21st printing, that means how many copies have been?
About 230-some thousand sold.
Wow, that's amazing. And the book was launched just late last year, yeah. So it's... So the book has been on the bestseller list. It's gotten a phenomenal audience. Yet it is on something that is, especially for someone like me who comes from that developing world, something that is so commonplace, something so entrenched and so widespread, most journalists don't even consider it as news. You've talked about more girls being killed as girls, because they are girls, than people who perished in the wars of the 20th century. Why this book, and why now?
Really it was a gradual process for Cheryl, my wife, and me. We spent a lot of time abroad, and I think it gradually snuck up on us that really the central human rights cause, if you will, and it seemed to us more broadly, the central moral challenge of our times was this kind of gender inequity. And you know, when I say that, I think people always think this is really meant in some kind of hyperbolic sense. But can I ask you folks a question? Are there more males or females in the world today? Come on. Let's have a show of hands. If you think there are more males in the world today, can you raise your hand? And if you think there are more females in the world today, can you raise your hand? I'm afraid this latter group is wrong for the reason that Sheila just mentioned, that you know, in the U.S. there are more females. In Europe, there are more females. In this room, I think there are pretty much more females. Given equal access to food and health care, women live longer. In an equal world, there would be more women, but it's not an equal world. And when we began to realize the toll of this and realize that you have somewhere between 50 and 110 million women missing from the globe, now that in any 10 years you have more girls who were discriminated against to death than all the victims of all the genocides of the 20th century, just the scale of it struck us as something that really deserved more attention, more coverage. And I think it was some combination of that intellectual realization of the scale of this, coupled just with the things we encountered, that made us think that this is something that we wanted to write about. We essentially, as writers, we have a spotlight, and you get a lot more bang for the buck when you illuminate something that is not illuminated, that is in the dark, and you know, help draw attention to it.
But why now? Haven't there been more strides that have been taken by women in the last generation or so than there have been, say, in the last 100 years? Aren't there more women, as you can see, in colleges, more women in schools, at least in many parts of the development, more women in the professions, more women who are taking on leadership roles in governments, in companies?
Yeah, I mean, I think, in fact, this book could have been written approximately any point in the last 400,000 years. I guess we would have had to have, since Gutenberg anyway, it would have worked better since Gutenberg. I mean, one answer to that is indeed, you know, our appreciation of the issue. I mean, not ourselves, but in general, I think the public has become increasingly aware of this. And part of it also is that, aside from the issues of injustice that are out there, human trafficking, girls being discriminated against to death, the other side of the coin is a more optimistic one, and that is that there's an increasing appreciation, I think, that if you want to address global poverty, civil conflict in societies, even terrorism, then there's no magic solution, but educating girls, bringing those educated women into the formal labor force, probably accomplishes more than any other single strategy you can pursue. And I think the contrast between Pakistan and Bangladesh is an interesting one in that respect. I mean, there are various differences, but one is that Bangladesh really went out of its way to educate girls in a way that Pakistan did not. And that, in turn, helped revitalize Bangladesh's economy, Bangladesh's civil society, and I think is one reason why Bangladesh is rather more stable today. Although, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate that too much. But I guess this is a long way of saying that increasingly, that it's always been evident that terrible things have happened to women. What is becoming more evident over time is that if you want to make strides against global poverty, against these other problems, then one way of doing that is to focus on girls' schooling and these other issues. And you know, to me, it strikes me, covering Afghanistan, that one of the metrics that American commanders use in Afghanistan is the proportion of girls who are going to school, because they realize that those districts are going to be more stable. So you have these hard-bitten military commanders who one moment are talking about airstrikes, and the next moment they're talking about getting more girls in school. And I think that's a powerful reminder that there are ways to achieve stability in societies that don't necessarily involve dropping incredibly expensive bombs on villages.
Since this is a conversation about conflict, can you talk more about the relationship between the state or the status of women and civil conflict or religious conflict?
The correlation between societies where women are marginalized and those that have more conflict is fairly well established as an empirical matter. The reason for that is, you know, is open to speculation. I think that the pathway has to do in part with the youth cohort, the baby boom, or the population bulge. It's long been known that countries that have a demographic bulge of people between the age of 15 and 24 are much more prone to terrorism, to civil conflict, to upheaval. And societies where women are marginalized are in turn much more likely to have very high fertility rates and to have that kind of a youth bulge. But in addition, on top of that, I think it is reasonably clear that probably what matters more than just the proportion of the overall population that is 15 to 24 is the proportion of the population that is young men aged 15 to 24. And in those societies where women are completely marginalized and they stay in the home and they're not in the workforce, then in effect that magnifies the proportion of young men, their impact on society. And those societies tend to take on, to some extent, the ethos of an armed camp, boys' locker room, you know, prison, whatever the metaphor is that you want to pursue. There's a certain amount of work in the field of sociology that looks at where you get these very male-oriented societies and the conflict that tends to arise. And the final element of this, I think, is that those societies also often end up being polygamous, and that reduces the number of young women who are available for these young men to marry. And the upshot may well be that you have a lot of young men in their mid-20s who otherwise might be finally getting married and settling down, who stay single and, in effect, 15 to 24, even when actually they're in their late 20s. And so I think that all these things, that it's in part a function of this demographic aspect, but that it magnifies it and creates this kind of instability.
2 weeks ago, we saw these bombings in Moscow where there was this female suicide bomber. Right? I mean, can you relate that incident to this sort of pathology that, or this situation that you described?
Well, I think that, I mean, women tend to be certainly marginalized in those societies, and the fact that they're occasionally given a suicide vest, I don't think changes that fundamental dynamic. But I also think it is important to note that, you know, I think we often, from afar, exaggerate the degree to which this is a gender battle, this is men versus women. And it really isn't. One of the things that struck me the most in reporting the book was the degree to which you had women doing terrible things to other women. And, for example, if you look at brothel owners around the world, and, you know, in the U.S., pimps are men. But around the world, most brothel owners, most human traffickers are women. Most of the people who decide whether to cut a girl's genitals, FGM, it's the mothers. Men tend to be more excluded from that. Over and over, it's the mothers-in-law who make the decision about whether to take a young woman to hospital when she's in obstructed labor. And it's the mother-in-law who says, oh, you know, I gave birth at home, no need for her to go, and so she dies. If you ask people, are they in favor or against wife beating, then the best predictor of their answer is not whether they're male or female. Rather, it's how much education they have and whether they live in a city or a rural area. So, I mean, essentially, the problem here really is patriarchal and often misogynistic attitudes and values. But those attitudes and those values are absorbed and transmitted almost as much by women as by men.
In this book, and in much of your work, you take a stand, which not many journalists, at least in this country, do. You're not just reporting, but urging people to do something, to take action. Isn't that a risky position to take as a journalist?
Well, I mean, one risk is that I will prove wrong, which I do periodically. I mean, there are a couple of elements to that, I think. One is the notion of expressing opinions. And when I got the column in 2001, it felt incredibly strange to be writing my opinions in the column. And I'd show my draft columns to my wife, and she would look at it and say, this opinion is pretty feeble. It looks more like a news analysis than a column. And I would sort of go back and add a few adjectives. But gradually it's become much more natural to hurl out opinions. And these are issues that I care passionately about and that I do have strong opinions of. And of course, in the world of columns, you're expected to throw opinions around. I think the other thing that I've done that has raised more eyebrows has been, to some degree, the injection of myself in some of the stories. And
Such as
in Cambodia, buying two girls from a brothel. In 2004, I bought two girls, one for $150, the other for just over $200, and returned them to their villages, worked with an aid group, I think that was the first time that a New York Times reporter had actually bought two human beings. I think that, that raised journalistic eyebrows. Is this really appropriate to be jumping into the story like that? And that has happened on things like that have happened a number of times.
That's also raised eyebrows, not just among journalists, but also among feminists, because it was like playing to the trope of a white man rescuing these poor third world girls from misery and a lifetime of abuse. Does that bother you?
Well, it bothered me much less than the alternative of leaving them in the brothel to get AIDS and die. You're right that did indeed. I mean, I think it made people uncomfortable for that reason. I must say it didn't make the two people in question uncomfortable because, again, given the alternative that they get stuck in the brothel, it seemed rather better to them fit into a stereotype, I guess. One of the problems that relates to that a little bit that does bother me more, that I wonder about, is that when I go and do some reporting, then I typically try to find some microcosm, some way of telling the story. And so, for example, in Haiti, I wanted to tell about some aid group doing something interesting as a way of building a narrative that would tell the story. And I'm a huge believer in that often local organizations, in that case a Haitian organization, are the ones that actually have the most local knowledge, tend to be most cost effective, and that often we would get more bang for the buck if we would tend to support local organizations abroad. But those of you who read the column know that very often I pick organizations run by Americans. I'll pick, my protagonist will be some American from Columbia or wherever it may be, who's off in the middle of nowhere. And the reason, basically, is that it's an awful lot easier to get readers to read about some New Yorker who's off in Haiti, for example, than to get them to read about a Haitian who's doing good work in Haiti. And it's already so hard to get readers to, to care about Congo or Darfur or whatever the issue is, that to miss the chance to create this kind of a protagonist, this kind of a vehicle that can help tug people in, strikes me as a missed opportunity. But I am very sensitive to the notion that that I'm sort of highlighting the wrong kind
of hero
sometimes.
The good work that Americans do rather than the good work that local people have
exactly.
to do. But I think one reason for the success of your book and your reporting is precisely because you tell these compelling stories. Half the sky is full of these compelling stories of women who've undergone the most horrible abuse and yet overcome them. This storytelling technique is a deliberate one, isn't it? I mean, you've talked about this in previous forums, your reading of marketing specialists and social psychologists. Can you talk more about this?
Sure, I'm laying bare the secrets in my cupboard here.
The Save the Darfur Puppy Syndrome, as you said in one of your columns. Yeah,
that's right. Really, the origins for this came when some of my earlier columns from Darfur, and I was just very frustrated that I was writing about hundreds of thousands of people being driven from their homes, vast numbers of people dying, starving, and you know, I'd write the columns and they just kind of seem to disappear without a trace. And if those of you who were in New York then may remember that there was a hawk, a red-tailed hawk in Central Park, Pale Male, that was kicked out of his nest in a condo there. And New Yorkers were all up in arms about this red-tailed hawk being homeless. And I couldn't get people to care nearly as much about hundreds of thousands of people. And so then that was enormously frustrating, and it drove me to try to understand what resonates in us, what makes us act or care about an issue. And I came across work in a little bit in neurology, but mostly in social psychology, that goes to exactly this question. And we flinch at the idea of marketing a cause. We think that marketing is what Coke and Pepsi do. And obviously they do, and they do with incredible sophistication, even though it doesn't matter to the world one whit whether we drink Coke or drink Pepsi. On the other hand, it would matter tremendously if we can get people to care about malaria or you know, whatever it may, girls' education around the world. And we don't invest the same energy or attempts to build those connections. And the lessons that have been, I think, learned from social psychology are, you know, one, it's all about individual stories, that we know intellectually that our interest in helping a class of people diminishes as that class gets longer. You know, one death is a statistic, and I'm sorry, one death is a tragedy, a million is a statistic. On the other hand, what becomes clear is the point at which our empathy diminishes. You know what the number is? It's when the number of victims reaches two. The moment you have more than one victim, then empathy and sympathy diminish.
You use the example of Rokia, right?
Yes.
The woman from Mali. Maybe you could use that, yeah.
The all of these studies have revolved around a 7-year-old girl called Rokia, who is the social psychologists seem to love. And it's typically, in various situations, would you help Rokia? And, you know, in some cases there's a boy equivalent of Rokia. And, you know, it turns out that everybody wants to help Rokia. You just have a picture of Rokia. She's hungry. People want to help her. Nobody wants to help 21 million hungry West Africans, another version. But even if it's just Rokia and this boy's name, which I now forget, nobody wants to help, or they don't really want to help the two of them. They want to help either one or the other, but not both. And most confounding, if you provide background information, if you say that Rokia is malnourished because there has been a drought in Mali, because there are many, many other people who are hungry there, then again, people's interest lags. It's very much an emotional connection. The other aspect that is that people want to be a part of a positive story. They want to be in a situation where Rokia is hungry, and you feed her, and then she lives happily ever after. And I think that one of the mistakes that humanitarian organizations make is that they overdo the misery and the tragedy of it. And people really don't want to be a part of something terribly sad. Again, there are that's really the reason why so many of the anecdotes in our book take this course, where it's somebody whose you know, trajectory plumbs the absolute bottom of humanity, but then manages to rise above it, to overcome this, to really be inspiring, heartwarming, positive. And it was a reflection of this research in social psychology that that's what we kind of yearn for. And so the book was kind of an experiment in, you know, whether that would resonate.
Has it been successful in achieving this aim, in getting people to sympathize with these women and doing actually some of the things that you asked them to do in the book, which is to contribute to these organizations, help women out in developing countries, and so on?
Yeah, it's been, I think it's been very successful in, you know, opening up people's eyes to things happening a long way away and in getting some people to connect with these issues. We wanted to, in effect, write a sort of a do-it-yourself guide to foreign aid or foreign policy. And one of the other potential pitfalls or minefields is that there's a tendency with any good cause for people to exaggerate and make it seem more important or easier, in other words, to oversell. And I think that people on the fence are very skeptical of that. They sense it. And that when we looked at historical analogies, one of the things that had worked was those efforts that had really, if anything, undersold rather than oversold. And so we tried to, you know, acknowledge that helping people is harder than it looks, doesn't always work, and yet, you know, these are some of the kinds of interventions that have the best record. Here's what you can do yourself. And it's been particularly exciting for us when there have been a lot of young people who have, after reading the book, have then wanted to give their parents gray hairs and go off to, you know, Ghana, Somaliland, wherever it may be.
The way you're talking now is very different from the way a lot of journalists, American journalists I know, at least a lot of the journalism professors in this school talk. I mean, you're talking about marketing a cause. You're talking about getting people to actually do something. You're going beyond opinionating, if there is such a word, to asking people to take concrete action based on what they've read.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, I think that's, true.
Are you making the line between being an advocate and a journalist? Are you blurring that line between advocacy and journalism? Is probably the best way to phrase that question.
I mean, to some degree, it's a fine line, and I must say that people will periodically come up to me and say, Nick, you're such a great crusader or something, and I will flinch at that, and, you know, because that suggests the notion, as an advocate, that one maybe isn't, that one's primary loyalty is to a cause or an issue, and that one becomes somewhat less skeptical of that along the way. And I think it's that kind of journalistic skepticism is incredibly important at every step. On the other hand, you know, Cheryl and I wrote Half the Sky not just to inform people, but ultimately because we really do think this is a moral challenge. And, you know, on the human trafficking, for example, you go out and you meet girls who are locked up in brothels and who are going to die of AIDS as a result, and it doesn't just feel like an important story, it feels like a horrific human tragedy. And, you know, I think a lot of us went into journalism to some degree wanting to make a difference. It's a very fine line how you pursue that. You can't cover every city council meeting trying to make a difference, but on the other hand, you do hope that you do have some kind of a larger contribution, that it makes the world a better place. And on some of these issues that I gravitated to, I want to make people spill their coffee when they read the column. And, you know, after they've read the book, I do want them to go and donate, volunteer, whatever it may be, but help chip away at some of these problems.
That's great. Before we leave the book, let's talk about some of the criticisms that have been made about it, if only to save them the trouble of asking the questions. First one is, U.S. feminist aid underplays or makes light of women's oppression in the U.S. You say, you know, women are so oppressed in third world countries, while American feminists are more concerned with the glass ceiling and not life-threatening issues like that threaten women elsewhere.
I do think that American feminism and the human rights community traditionally both didn't focus enough on the issue of women's rights around the world. I do think that actually in both cases, over the last 10 years or so, they've become more attentive to these issues. In the case of, clearly there are enormous problems within this country. I think in the case of women's rights, the two probably most serious ones are domestic violence, which is a vast problem, and trafficking, which is also, a vast problem. And I don't mean to suggest that we should, be trying to end trafficking in India and not in New York. It's also true that if one looks at the scale of the problem, there's no question that the most egregious kinds of violations are abroad.
Second criticism from the more structural school, which is that the solutions that you offer are band-aid solutions, increasing spending on education for women, removing fistula operations, salt iodization, solutions that do not address the underlying causes of poverty and inequality in the world.
I've become more sympathetic to band-aids over the years. I think that especially when, for example, when I was in university, that there was a tendency to seek overarching solutions to problems. And frankly, the result was often things that were somewhat symbolic. It was to hold a conference or to pass a law. And there's clearly a role for laws for conferences. But on the other hand, I think that actually your generation, for those of you who are students, have been kind of better at actually doing something that makes an incremental difference for real people somewhere. That, instead of having a conference on ending female illiteracy, you'll sponsor a third grade class in a particular refugee camp somewhere. And it's not going to end the global problem, but for those third graders, it is transformational. And over time, I've become more sympathetic to the idea that that is something that actually makes more of a difference. I don't think one should ignore the other end, and especially in the case of health, clearly, some kind of interventions need to be kind of top-down, vaccination campaigns, whatever. But there is an awful lot to be said for these kind of individuals, the sort of band-aids, if you will. Can I tell a really hokey story?
Sure.
This is I traveled a lot with a Hawaiian cameraman, and we used to debate this issue a lot about, helping the sort of individuals, and he used to tell this utterly hokey Hawaiian parable, which I'm sure some of you have heard, but it very much kind of resonates with me about these issues. And it's about the a boy walking along the beach, and all these starfish have washed up. Do you know this? The boy is frantically throwing the starfish back into the water, and a man comes up and says, "What are you doing? There are millions of starfish that have been washed up. You can't make a difference." The boy throws in another one and says, "Well, sure made a difference to that one." And I think there's a lot to be said for that.
But it's this sort of hokiness and these kinds of stories that you bring out in your book that, more cynical development workers say that you're treating the issue of women's human rights like it were your personal discovery. When people have been working on this for the last two generations or so.
I mean, I think that there's genuinely some discomfort, and I sympathize with it for people. I mean, there have been so many people who have been working in this field for decades, for their lifetimes, and then it is frustrating to have, some guy come along and write a book, and then everybody starts talking about it, and they're right. I mean, I sympathize with it. And the success of Half the Sky is very much a credit to the groundwork that so many NGOs have done for years, for decades, kind of building awareness, building up evidence that these interventions do work. On the other hand, I think it is really important. I mean, one of the reasons I write about these issues in the Times and why we wrote the book is that if only women write about women's rights, then the cause is marginalized immediately. If one wants to get broad acceptance, it is really important to have, you know, dead white guys write about these kinds of issues. I think there's a bit of an analogy with gay rights, that gay rights began to get broader traction when you had a lot more straight people writing about them. And in the same way, you know, or more broadly, the Holocaust wasn't a Jewish issue. Civil rights weren't a black issue. And when you have 100 million women discriminated against to death around the world, that obviously isn't just a women's issue. And I think it is important to, you know, grill this really broad coalition to try to bring about change.
So what you've done is actually mainstream the issue into popular consciousness in the same way that you said, you know, Rachel Carson embedded an environmental awareness in the 1960s.
I mean, that's the goal. That is the goal.
Yeah. How do you keep up the energy to do this, Nick? I mean, you're probably on the road how many months in a year?
I'm always nervous Child Protective Services is going to take one of these lectures and take away my kids.
Yes, exactly. But also, don't you get compassion fatigue? I mean, after seeing the 24th woman who's been forced to work in the brothel, don't you just stop feeling anything about it?
To some extent, one does encounter compassion fatigue, and I'm sometimes embarrassed by how clinical I can become when I'm out reporting that I'm leaving this weekend to go to Sudan, for example, and I'll be in rural areas. I won't have much time, and I'll be out to try to find the most compelling story that I can within limited time. So somebody will come to me and they'll tell me a story about, some heart-wrenching story about some, 30-year-old man. And frankly, I will know that I can do better as an anecdote, that if I want to get American readers to care about my story, if I have some middle-aged man in my lead, they're going to tune out. And so what I'm looking for is some, maybe it's going to be some 9-year-old girl with soulful eyes, whatever it may be, but some story that can get readers in to the column. And so I'm sometimes kind of embarrassed by the way I will, cut somebody off and say, well, it's terrible that you were shot in the leg, but, meanwhile, I'll go off and find somebody who was shot in both legs or was shot in the stomach I really want to find just the most compelling anecdote, the way I can get readers into those stories.
One reviewer who reviewed a documentary made about you and your trip with students to Africa said that you're a cross between Mother Teresa and the James Woods character in Salvador. Do you guys know the James Woods character is in this very intense foreign journalist who just is like obsessive compulsive and just runs around with the heart of Mother Teresa? Is that an accurate description?
Well, I'm trying to remember. I think I watched the movie ages ago. Without remembering much of that character, I think that is probably a little closer to the cross than Mother Teresa. I usually leave my habit at home.
But you have succeeded in creating a sort of niche for yourself. There is, I think, sort of Nick Kristoff brand, however you describe it. It's sort of an engaged journalism in difficult parts of the world, but also the less obvious stories, the less headline-grabbing stories.
The reason I choose the more obscure stories to some degree really reflects a realization, awakening that I had after I got the column. When I got the column at the end of 2001, initially I thought, wow, I'm going to be molding people's opinions over breakfast twice a week. Boy, am I powerful. It turned out, in fact, that if I write about anything that people have already thought about, if I write about gun control, healthcare, Middle East policy, then by and large, I won't change their minds. If they start out agreeing with me, they think I'm brilliant. If they start out disagreeing with me, they think I've utterly missed the point. And I think that we exaggerate the degree to which pundits actually influence public opinion because, you know, we tend to find them very influential when we start out agreeing with them. And in contrast, at least for me, I found that where I really can have an impact isn't actually writing about those things that are on the agenda already, but it's shining the spotlight on some kind of uncomfortable truth out there and helping bring awareness to it, helping put it on the agenda. And so increasingly over time, it's been, you know, as a result, it's been to the Darfur or Eastern Congo or trafficking or fistula, maternal health, whatever it may be.
How long do you think you can keep doing this? I mean, I'm asking it not, I mean, partly on a personal reason, how sustainable it is from your point of view, but also in terms of the changes that are now taking place in the media industry, where there's fewer resources for international reporting, there's less, you know, people's attention is being dispersed among so many news sites, there's an information overload. Is this sustainable?
If you will buy copies of the New York Times, it's certainly true that there's a real crisis in journalism as a whole, and television in particular has largely dropped the ball on covering the world. Television is not covering Eastern Congo, these kinds of issues. The New York Times, thank God, still is paying my bills, is happy to send me off to these places. And so I think that it's sustainable for me writing for the New York Times for the foreseeable future. It's also, at a personal level, I think that maybe there's one element of there is, at what point do you just, do you kind of just burn out? I mean, just become just really depressing. And, the truth is, I think people often think that it's incredibly depressing to run around war zones, Cambodian brothels, wherever it may be. And the truth is that usually in the places where you see the worst of humanity, you also see the very best of humanity. And when people are tested in those ways, they do terrible things, they also do extraordinarily wonderful things. And what I usually come back from these places feeling utterly inspired by some of the people I've met there. In Eastern Congo, I was aghast at some of the victims that I met and the stories they told me and the warlords I met. But the single person who just left the deepest impression on me was actually this Polish nun in the town of Rutsuru, at a time when it had been abandoned by aid workers. She was keeping orphans alive, feeding starving children, keeping out thugs and soldiers, and it was just an incredible example of how somebody expresses their humanity by looking after those around them. And so I just came back and I wanted to grow up and become a Polish nun. Maybe that was the closest I got to Mother Teresa aspiration.
Okay, last two questions before we ask our audience to ask their own questions. First is the Barbara Walters question. What was the worst thing ever said about you? This is how she gets people to talk about unpleasant things.
I think that there's a critique of my reporting. There are many plausible critiques, but one is that I tend to go off and focus on kind of the worst stories and the grimmest places, and that it becomes something close to genocide porn, if you will, and that it also at times magnifies the sense of contempt that a lot of Americans have for poor countries. I think that one of Africa's problems, for example, is getting tourists, is getting Western investors. And if I go around, and if in general reporters go around and go to the worst performing parts of that continent and tell those stories, then that tends to leave Americans thinking that, well, that's Africa. And, you know, those are legitimate criticisms that I worry about.
Well, let's just say I've heard worse things said about journalists. So. The last question is the Mark Taylor question, and it is, what keeps you awake at night?
I think the thing that I worry about most, it's not the horror stories that when I've interviewed somebody, you do build up some kind of numbness, if you will, to those. It tends to be issues of safety and security, either involving you or involving somebody whose safety we're responsible for. And in particular, one of the things that I think we don't always appreciate is how any kind of foreign reporter who goes to Sudan, Zimbabwe, wherever it may be, is very dependent on a local reporter, a local driver, interpreter, whatever it may be. And in general, those people are the ones who take all the risks, get none of the credit, and, after you leave, they're there behind. One of my rules after a couple of problems is that when I'm in a really nasty, thuggish area, I try not to have columns pointing that out appear until after I've left, and that helps keep me safe. But if the government figures out who has helped me tell those stories, then that person is at risk. And I don't. So far, so good. But I'm always nervous that I'm going to Sudan this weekend, and on one trip to Sudan, I was stopped at a checkpoint, and the guys at the checkpoint tried to arrest my interpreter, 19-year-old kid who's studying English at a local university. I hired him for a few days, and they told us to go on, and they said, we're just going to hold him for investigation. And I was afraid that, we both thought that investigation was going to end 10 minutes later with him getting a bullet in his head. And for people at that checkpoint, that would have been entirely in character. And in fact, we were able to resolve it and get him out of trouble. But those kinds of things really do terrify me.
Well, thank you for answering those questions. I'd like to invite our audience. Are there microphones? There are microphones on this side of the room to ask their questions. So the first one who gets to the microphone first gets to ask the first question. I think you should speak closer to the mic. Yeah. Can you try that microphone as well so that we save time? Yeah. Is it working?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
My name is Wazanai. I'm a journalism student here, and I'm from Zimbabwe. I just want to thank you for writing that column. I read it yesterday, and it was very compelling. But I wanted to just find out, as a journalist, how do you reconcile, writing a balanced report? I understand that you want to shine a light on a certain situation, but if someone is reading the story, and that's the only impression they have of the country. As a journalist, do you see it as your responsibility to show the different sides of a situation?
I think that the area where that troubles me the most is less in terms of an individual country and more about the continent as a whole. And there it really does trouble me. And I mean, what I try to do, and it's not very successful, is that periodically I will do a column, for example, about various successes. But it's a pretty feeble response. I mean, the way I justify it to myself is that covering Congo, for example, so much is that, if you think about how many hundreds of thousands of deaths there have been for every column inch that the Congo War has gotten, then it's the most undercovered war in history. So how can one say there should be less coverage of it and more of the successes? But that issue of trying to provide some kind of a greater mosaic of the good and bad for the continent as a whole, it really does trouble me.
Well, thank you, though, for writing that article.
Yeah, thank you.
For Americans, two of the most common pathways to working on global development issues are the Peace Corps and the Foreign Service. And I was wondering if you could offer your critiques of those programs for young people looking to work abroad, and what you would do specifically to change and reform.
First of all, I just really encourage those of you who are thinking about it, to go abroad and take some time, and don't just go with a herd of other students to Paris or Florence, but get out of your comfort zone and get out of the capitals and ideally embed yourself in some little community, some project somewhere. For that kind of thing, the State Department isn't really so good. I mean, the Foreign Service tends to keep you in this little foreign ghetto in the capital, often have somewhat limited interaction with the local people. Various aid groups tend to be pretty good at that. Even just teaching. My son is a high school senior, so he's thinking about a gap year for next year, and so he's looking at options that would embed him in the middle of nowhere. I'm thinking about chartering a plane to drop him off with about $4 in cash in the middle of the Gabonese jungle, and sort of charting his journey out. Don't tell him I said that. But I think that this kind of that getting people truly out of their comfort zone in some project somewhere is a really important experience to have. And Peace Corps is one way of doing that.
Just to follow up, you've been critical of the Peace Corps, and just if you could elaborate on that.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think the main problem with Peace Corps is that it's this fairly long commitment. It's a 27-month commitment, and so I think, and it doesn't really fit very well into people's graduate school schedules. So I think it tends to get people who are already deeply interested in development, but not people who, people sign up for TFA for, because they have a little bit of time between college and whatever they want to do next, and it's kind of just a thing to do. You don't sign up for Peace Corps that lightly, and I wish there were a program that did offer people an alternative to do something similar to Peace Corps, but just for 1 year, for example, and to go abroad and teach. And, I'm under no illusions. Great beneficiaries of this would be Americans, not the people they would be teaching. But I think this would really be great for those individuals and for American foreign policy as a whole.
Hi there. I liked your remarks about demographics, 15 to 25 males, level of education, and poverty as correlates for marginalization of women. Scholars at the University of Vermont indicate that concentration of wealth is also a leading indicator of violence in any society. Do you think that marginalization of women may be a tool used to keep wealth concentrated? And I guess that's really the question. And leaving it out of reporting, does that perhaps contribute to this issue about contemptibility, but for the wrong reasons and the wrong people?
One of the things that I find distressing in some societies is that the wealthy elite, who tend to be very well educated, that their solution to this kind of upheaval and unrest tends to be to build really good protections for themselves rather than to try to educate the broader population, for example. The role of the traditional feudal elite in Pakistan, I think, is one example of that, where they've been really good at building barricades and have invested negligible effort in trying to support broader education. I do think that is beginning to change with middle class emerging in places like Pakistan and India as well, and that the middle class is beginning to show more interest in these kinds of issues in a way that the feudal elites did not. And that potentially has a real opportunity to begin to address these issues, bring about change, because fundamentally, at the end of the day, one isn't going to end these problems from Columbia University or from the New York Times. They're going to change because people within those countries are leading that charge, and we can support it, but we're only going to be Sherpas to their work.
Hi. My question is informed by Chris Hedges' book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. And you touched on this a little bit at the end, but just to preface, in the book he talks about how there's a lot of conflict reporters that basically become addicted to war and danger, and so they're just going to keep covering it until they get killed. So how do you balance getting close enough into the action to actually know what you're talking about with mitigating the risk enough that you can reasonably expect to survive a lifetime of that kind of work?
I spend so much of my time scared the fear tends to overcome the addiction part of it. It's also true that in general the addiction tends to come when you have a bunch of reporters in a crisis zone sitting together at the bar in the hotel where they're all staying, talking about how they're all going to, okay, we can go to tomorrow Jalalabad. I think that road to Jalalabad is going to be safe, or we can get on local buses and wear burqas and nobody's going to notice. I mean, people, when you get a bunch of reporters together, especially over a few beers, then competitive instincts start to blossom and people do things that that they wouldn't do. I find it safer to, hang out by myself and just be terrified. That tends to be a pretty good instinct. One of the other central rules of traveling in war zones, never accept a lift from a photographer or cameraman. They are crazy. When there's gunfire, any sane person will, immediately stop, ask questions, whatever. And if you're driving, that's okay. You can give a lift to the photographer. But if they're driving, gunfire, oh, hit the accelerator, got to get there while they're still shooting. I've had enough bad experiences that have taught me that things can be going perfectly well one moment, and then all of a sudden there's not, and there's no way out. And so I try to be very careful.
Thank you.
My name is Annie. I'm also a journalism student here. And I was wondering if you would reflect a bit on this statement that you made at the beginning of the talk about how many women seem to be sort of perpetuating violence or oppression of other women. I just wanted you to clarify a bit more, because as far as I understand it, these cultures have sort of evolved to become that way, and I'm not sure that the women sort of consciously oppress others, but it's like sort of a set perception that they've evolved to sort of espouse. And I'm wondering if that's like sort of treading very precarious grounds, because then we also have get into the danger of kind of imposing our culture upon another culture and suggesting that perhaps it's superior to theirs.
It's a really important question. And this question of when cultures clash, and are we imposing our culture on another? Are we suggesting that our culture is superior, for example? And it's one that Cheryl and I have wrestled with a fair amount. At some point, there I think two answers to that: one, a kind of theoretical one that we have to answer ourselves, and the other, a practical one of how one brings about change. at a theoretical level, answering to oneself, I think it seems to me that one has to wrestle with it, and it seems to me that the answer is sometimes that there are going to be elements of a culture that are indeed better or not as good as those in others. And Cheryl, when she's asked that question, talks about foot binding. Foot binding was she's Chinese American, foot binding was very much a part of her culture. And for hundreds of years, and Cheryl's grandmother had her feet bound, and there were, thank goodness, there were a lot of people protesting that it was a really bad element of Chinese culture. On the other hand, it clearly doesn't work for a bunch of Americans to go around and arrive in a foreign country and say, oh, your culture is barbaric. And I think too often that something like that has been the approach that we've tended to take. And I think there's a very good example in the case of FGM, female genital mutilation. There's really been an international, and this kind of goes back to this larger question of global solutions and structural solutions. Since really the 1920s, but especially since the 1970s, there's been an effort to ban FGM, and laws passed, conferences held, and it was rebranded female circumcision to female genital mutilation. And all this effort essentially had zero impact. I was in Guinea last year, where FGM is not only illegal, but in some cases punishable by execution. 99% of girls are still cut. In contrast, there have been some local efforts from within cultures, from within religions and societies, to end FGM. And those have been remarkably successful. And I think that if more of our efforts try to bring about change within cultures, not by standing in front with a megaphone telling people about the flaws in their culture, but rather supporting local change makers from within and being shirtless to them, that we would accomplish an awful lot more.
Nicholas, you spoke about making a connection with leaders so they took action. How did you get these women to open up to you?
It's actually, a lot of these issues, especially obviously issues having to do with rape or sex, are often taboo. And somebody might tell nobody else in their community. In some cases, they may not have even told their husband. But I'm a Martian. I show up and plunk myself into their community, and it's easier to confess this kind of thing to a Martian than it is to somebody you will see in your community thereafter. And so it can be very, and I ask really awkward questions. Sometimes the interpreter will blanch and say, I have to ask that. But I say yes, and surprisingly often, person will answer and answer honestly. I think that, in the case of Reagan and Darfur, there was also a sense among a lot of women, and as you see it in Congo too, that terrible things have been done to them, to other women, and they can't fight back in other ways. One thing they can do is to tell the world, if you will, to get the word out. And so they do want the word to get out, although they're embarrassed, they're ashamed. They often think that they have done something wrong. There's deep ambivalence, but at the end of the day, they usually do want the world to know what is going on.
Thank you.
Hi. First of all, thanks for coming. It's very interesting to listen to. You mentioned that a goal of yours is to mainstream the issue of gender rights and women rights. How instrumental do you think your book was in actually getting the issue of gendercide on the cover of The Economist a couple of weeks ago? And how do you like the coverage that you did?
I'd love to claim credit for the gendercide cover on The Economist. I have no idea whether that whether the person who wrote that cover story just read Half the Sky or whether it was something they were, you know, were interested in for a long time. There are certainly other people who have written about it periodically over time. This question of, you know, I mean, it's hard to mainstream an issue with a book because in general, the people who tend to buy a book and read a book about a topic tend to be those who already care about it. And so so Cheryl and I have been trying to wrestle with this question, and I think it'll be easier with the paperback. And some colleges have chosen Half the Sky as a freshman read, and we love that because then, you know, you expose a lot of people who you force them to to encounter issues that they might not naturally gravitate to. And likewise, television. There looks as if there's going to be a TV documentary series, and then the technology that we're kind of playing with the most is, in this respect, is online games. Who knew that we had game rights to the book? Well, it turns out we did, and so we gave them to a group called Games for Change, which is executive producing a online sort of social action campaign game. It'll be out quite a while from now, but it's kind of in the works. And the idea is that, you know, the zero barrier, if people play a game, it can go viral, it can expose people to something, and that by once they're exposed to it, draw them in and get them more engaged. And so if I tell you more about the game, I'll have to kill you, but but stay tuned.
Thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate it. I was wondering, I've recently seen some of the videos that you've produced. One, you were in Congo right after the earthquake in Haiti. And two questions kind of came up from watching those. One, as a journalist, I was wondering how you got people to trust you. That has kind of come up. And you were mentioning being a Martian, kind of playing a nobody rather than everybody. But I also was wondering about the videos themselves. I mean, you have people who are telling you very personal, private things about, for example, being raped or whatnot. Are you showing these to those people? I mean, in some sense, the more digital we get, I just wonder if that's something that happens. I mean, with an article, that might be different, and you're publishing this for a new maybe New York Times audience, so that's not necessarily these people in rural Congo. So I just kind of was curious about that.
There's a real problem with getting any kind of meaningful consent from somebody. I mean, obviously you need to get consent, but to what extent can it really be meaningful in the case of a video if it's somebody who has never been on the internet, doesn't really know what the New York Times is, that is something that, you know, we wrestle with. It would maybe a problem less in Congo, where the videos were probably less likely to really enrage any particular faction. In Darfur, you know, the government was denying that these rapes were taking place. A woman who confessed having been raped was at risk for being prosecuted for adultery if she was married, or fornication if she was unmarried. And there have been women who have been arrested, flogged, jailed for these things. And I just agonized over this question. I mean, if, on the one hand, if you just describe this in generic terms, you don't have an individual, you can't get people to care about it. It's only when you have a real person and a real photo you can get people to worry about it. And so my solution was, other than to get what consent you can, to try to shoot them in ways where, well, the names tend to be very commonly used, so Magbula. And so if I say she's Magbula, age 19, in Kama camp, there are a million Magbulas who are 19, and ages tend to be very flexible anyway. But I don't say what village they're from, what tribe they are, their father's name, things that the authorities can use to track them down. And, you know, so far, so good. Nobody got in trouble, but that's one of those things I do lose sleep over at night.
I'd like to commend you for your columns and the amount of sense that the victims that you concentrate on are third world, or, let's say, terrorism victims, as opposed to first world, as opposed to Western victims of terror or Israeli victims of terror, as opposed to third world? In other words, does it go by culture, or is it the individuals themselves and the needs that they have and the problems that they have?
I mean, I tend to focus on the these issues that I choose largely because they tend to be neglected, and that with by shining my light on something that people are not paying attention to, I can change the dynamic, get more resources applied to them, and so that tends to affect how I allocate those resources. I've been thinking that I should probably do more on some of the domestic poverty in this country, for example. I've been playing around a little with education in this country. I'll probably go to Pine Ridge Reservation in this country, which is probably the reservation with the most desperate poverty in this country. I'd like to do more on some of these issues. But it's really this question that I think I get the most bang for the buck, the most impact for my real estate and op-ed page by focusing on things that are completely neglected.
Hi, I first of all wanted to thank you for all of the writing that you did on healthcare in this country. So really, affects this country, and I really thought it was powerful, and I was able to use it and forward it to people and change their minds about that. But what I wanted to ask you is about crowdsourcing. I'm one of your Facebook fans and one of your many Twitter followers, and there's a lot of very optimistic things being said about crowdsourcing, especially with the Iran elections and the Haiti earthquake. People were able to get information that they wouldn't have been able to get other ways. And I hear many more optimistic things about it so than pessimistic things. I looked up Darfur in Wikipedia, and the entire entry didn't use the word genocide at all. Which I found really surprising, and is maybe an example of crowdsourcing not working, or maybe there's something I didn't understand. I didn't really know, but I was just wondering what your take on it was as a whole.
The Pine Ridge, I mentioned going to Pine Ridge. Actually, that was suggested when I asked, people on my Facebook page, so should I do more domestic stuff? And somebody, people had different views, but somebody gave Pine Ridge as an example of something that I, it's a good place, and I sort of thought, that's right. I can't guarantee that if you all rush off to my Facebook page and put in your favorite cause that I'll necessarily be swayed, but there are times when really good ideas come up on that. I think better ideas tend to come up on Facebook than on blog entries, probably because Facebook has more accountability, because your friends see what you've done on Facebook and can have smarter ideas. Doesn't always work. I'm planning my next winter trip journey, and I asked, trying to figure out how long it takes to get from Libreville, Gabon, to Brazzaville, Congo, and I asked on Twitter, and I got a zillion people who said, "Oh, according to my map, it's X number of miles." Well, I was actually trying to figure out how many days it was going to be, but finally, I got several people seemed to have a consensus that one day's drive you could get from Libreville to Brazzaville, and so I began plotting my journey on that basis, and for my Twitter readers, it looks like it's at least three days drive, depending on the roads. So it's a mixed bag, but there are times when I've certainly benefited from it.
Thanks very much for coming. What are some specific professions that are helping the most people the most?
I think there. I think one can do a lot of work in a lot of different fields. And know, obviously for me, journalism has been a way that I feel like I can chip away at some problems in the world, but you know, for others, it's teaching, it's medicine, it's public health, it's advocacy, it's public, public service. And I also think that it's, you know, it's business, for that matter. And I don't, you know, I think it's up to everybody how they, what they want to do and how they want to do something. But one thing I really would suggest is that you find some niche in your life to connect with a cause larger than yourself. And don't just think, oh, I'm going to work really hard for the next 40 years and then I'm going to retire and, you know, spend money on good causes. I think that for your own sake, as much as anybody else's, it's really good to have one element of your life at least be something that has some kind of a higher social purpose, that not just because it does good to other people, because it does good to you. It helps lend a thread of fulfillment in your own life.
Thank you so much for coming. My question kind of combines two that were already asked, but in a different way. With the media landscape so different than it used to be and constantly transforming day by day, someone who wants to get involved in international reporting and doesn't necessarily work for a newspaper or, you know, isn't an established journalist yet, it almost seems overwhelming to even consider how you would get started doing that sort of work. I mean, it used to be that you could just go apply for a job as a reporter and then, you know, hopefully go and cover whatever you wanted to cover. And now, if you want to cover something, it seems that there are many different ways to go about that. So someone who does want to cover international stories and be an international reporter, how would you, you know, what would you advise them to do?
I don't have any brilliant, you know, silver bullet solutions, but I mean, obviously what some people do is they actually go off and work for a newspaper that is based abroad, typically an English language paper. The Cambodia Daily has a long tradition of taking really smart young Americans who go over and work on the Cambodia Daily for a while and just enjoy the thrill of being in Cambodia and then usually parlay that into a journalism job back in the States after a few years. And the same thing happens in a lot of places. Increasingly, obviously, you need to have some kind of multimedia experience. I think social media are important. The other thing, though, that I'd say is that as television drops the ball, more and more of what we think of as journalism is going to be provided by a combination of think tanks and maybe advocacy groups. I mean, you know, aid organizations could be doing an awful lot more of what we think about as journalism just with aid workers in the field, because they're actually there. And if they entrust them to blog, to Twitter, to Facebook, to shoot videos, that could be a really powerful tool. There's a chance now for YouTube videos to go viral if they're really well done. And if I were, you know, running an aid group, I would, I'd hand out, you know, flip cameras and try to get people on the ground who you can put together some really cool videos that might go viral, might spread the word. But unfortunately, I'm not running an aid group, so can't hire you. But but you know, but there are options out there, I think.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Lola. I'm an undergraduate here at
Northwestern
University. I'm curious about Columbia College. I've not yet read Half the Sky, but I have a question about yours and Cheryl's choice in titling the book. It's a reference to an oft-quoted Chairman Mao saying, oft-quoted in China at least. And maybe some members of the audience don't think of China as an exemplar of human rights. And I don't wish to make a definitive statement about China's human rights records, but I will say that in my time in the countryside in China, I do see a lot of slogans encouraging people to send their daughters to school and even saying, we'll pay you to send your daughters to school. Were you and Cheryl trying to hold up China as an example of a country that has succeeded in educating its girls? And if so, how can other developing countries follow there?
And part of it was simply that we were desperately trying to come up with a title, and the publisher didn't like our suggestions, and we didn't like their suggestions, and we all thought Half the Sky was kind of lyrical and it kind of worked. But the broader part of it is that, and this is something we talk about in the book, that one of the real impediments is that we psych ourselves out because we think that oppression against women is embedded in some foreign cultures and can't fight culture. And China is, I think, is a good example of the opposite, that 100 years ago, China was arguably the worst place in the world to be born female. You had foot binding, you had child marriage, you had female infanticide, concubinage, the whole works. And these days, it's one of the better places in the world to be born female. And it's precisely because of those kinds of changes that China has had its economic boom. Those factories in coastal China, those 70% of the employees in those factories are young women from the villages, from Hunan, from Guangxi, and so on, who ended up getting those jobs. And that economic boom was very much on the backs of these young women. And so there was a larger point we were trying to make as well.
Sorry, this would have to be our last question. I'm getting signals from the organizers here that we should.
I have a somewhat difficult question. You know, I'm surprised actually it hasn't come up yet. I've been following the recent scandals in the Vatican, and Marie Dowdhead and others, especially the latest Newsweek, had suggested that if women were in positions of leadership within the church, that that things would have taken a different turn earlier, and some of these things could have been prevented. As someone who's done all this research on the positive roles of women in positions of leadership, what are your views on whether this can be transferred to an area, whether it still applies for a religious area versus, say, the arena?
It seems to me that religion is indeed part of the problem in much of the world. Religion is typically evolved at times of great inequality and tended to sanctify that inequality. Intended to sort of say this is God's will, and in particular and in addition, one religion after another has the willies about menstruation, and that tends to, I think, add to this notion of women as ritually unclean in some respects, and adds to this the sense of women as second class citizens, and I think if one doctrinally is taught all the time that God sees husbands as in charge of wives, that does have some kind of a broader effect on one's values, one's attitudes. So I think that religions have truly been indeed part of the problem, one of the reasons for these kinds of inequities. Having said that, if you try to look at what the solutions are, it's also very clear that religion is part of the solution. And, you know, in Afghanistan, if you were trying to get more girls into school, or Pakistan, then you're not going to do it if you have a bunch of Americans who march in and just say, you know, get your girls to school. The people who have the greatest influence there are precisely the clerics. And the clerics are disproportionately educated, and partly as a result, in many cases, they do favor much broader girls' education. Likewise, in Africa, for example, the fastest growing religion, maybe in the world, is Pentecostalism, and I don't agree whatsoever with Pentecostal theology, a lot of the teaching is actually very much very traditional about men being in charge, but the reality is that in Pentecostal churches, women are very much invited to speak up in church. And the upshot is often that very often this is the first chance that an illiterate woman has ever had to speak up and to be given a sense of moral authority and to have people listen to her. And because Pentecostalism has spread so far in Africa and Latin America and elsewhere, it has become, a real vehicle for women's empowerment in much of the world, despite the very conservative social tone of so much of its teaching. So I think it's a complex issue, a complex picture, certainly part of the problem, but I think we also have to acknowledge that it's also going to be part of the solution.
Well, thank you, Nick, for answering all these questions. Thank you very much. You're not exempt from the rules.
I said one of the NICUs were complex twice was remarked. I said one of the problems it seems to be today is that we live in an extraordinarily complex world that nonetheless loves simplicity. And one of the depressing things about so much of what's going on in journalism, I think, for me, has been that the support for the kind of time that it takes to give reflection, the kind of reflection we've seen Nick give tonight to these complex problems is getting up is all too rare. It takes time to take reflection and that kind of depth of thought and depth of commitment that you show in your writing, you've shown tonight. We're deeply in your debt for all of that. These events I've learned over the past few years depend absolutely on the insight, the depth of the questions from the interlocutor. And Sheila, for your contribution tonight, we thank you very much. I'll remind you that Nick's generously offered to sign books in the back for any of you who would like to. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.